Welcome to Learning English on the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Today, we hear from Dan Friedel about the arrival of Olympic athletes to Brazil. Then, Ashley Thompson and I take you to another U.S. national park. And we finish up the program with an American story. Today, we hear The Furnished Room by O. Henry.
When the Australian athletes in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, arrived last weekend for the Olympic Games, they got a surprise. The team's housing in the athletes' village was not ready. Some of the hallways were dark. Electrical wiring had not been covered. The toilets did not work, and sinks were blocked. But after 4 days at a hotel, the Australian athletes finally moved in on Wednesday. Olympic organizers agreed that some buildings were not ready for occupancy after some disagreements between representatives of the Australian Olympic team and the mayor of Rio de Janeiro. Eduardo Paes is Rio's mayor. Earlier this week, he said that the Australian athletes might feel more comfortable if he placed a kangaroo at the door. But by midweek, the city and the Australian team were on better terms. Kitty Chiller is the head of the Australian Olympic delegation. She said the athletes' village is one of the best she has seen. She also said that the athletes may face other issues with the housing in the village, but it is just a matter of dealing with them as best we can in good humor. Chiller and members of the Australian team met with Mayor Paes on Wednesday. She brought him a small kangaroo toy. He presented the Australians with a ceremonial key to the city. Paes apologized for his comment about the kangaroo. He told a Brazilian television broadcaster it was a bad joke. He also said that he would be cheering for Australia at the Olympic Games along with Brazil's team. ABC, Australia's public broadcaster, reported that the Australian athletes even took the mayor's advice. They placed both a stuffed animal kangaroo and an emu by their front door. An emu is a large bird that cannot fly. It is only found in Australia. Argentina has also expressed concern about the housing for its athletes. But the Rio Olympic organizers said that 630 people are working all day and all night, so the village will be ready for the athletes. The opening ceremony is August 5th, but some soccer games begin earlier on August 3rd. Thomas Bach, the head of the International Olympic Committee, said there are always small problems that must be solved just before the games begin. We always had confidence in Brazil, in the Brazilians, that it will be a fantastic Olympic Games, he said. I'm Dan Friedel.
Today on our national parks journey, we head to the far western part of Texas. The landscape here is severe. The Chisos Mountains rise from the desert. The Rio Grande River cuts deep into ancient limestone rock. Cactus plants flower under the intense sun. Welcome to Big Bend National Park. At first sight, Big Bend seems empty of life, but the park is home to many plants and animals. Over 450 kinds of birds can be found within the park, along with 75 mammal species and more than 50 kinds of reptiles. The park's diversity comes from its three different ecosystems. Within the park are mountain, desert, and river environments.
The Rio Grande sustains the park. The river starts high up in the Rocky Mountains. Melting mountain snow is its main source. It travels more than 3,000 kilometers on its way to the Gulf of Mexico. The deep blue river cuts through the dry Chihuahuan Desert. Big Bend National Park contains the northernmost part of this desert. It is the second largest desert in North America. Much of the desert is south of the border in Mexico. The Rio Grande serves as an international border between the United States and Mexico for about 1,600 kilometers. The park itself shares a border with Mexico for 189 kilometers. The Chihuahuan Desert is the largest ecosystem in the park. 80% of the park is desert. Animals like jackrabbits, roadrunner birds, and mule deer live in the Chihuahuan. Many cactus and yucca species thrive. These are succulent plants. Most succulents have thick, heavy leaves that store water. Cacti store water in their stems.
High up in the park's Chisos Mountains, temperatures are much cooler than down on the desert floor. The entire Chisos Mountain range exists within Big Bend. It is the only mountain range in the United States that is fully within a national park. Its highest mountains, Emery Peak and Lost Mine Peak, each rise more than 2,000 meters above the hot desert floor. The woodland environment in the mountains is home to black bears, mountain lions, and gray foxes. It is also home to many kinds of birds. One of these is the Colima warbler. These small gray, yellow, and red birds arrive at Big Bend in the springtime to mate and nest. Then they return south to Mexico. In the late summer, mountain sage flowers appear. Hummingbirds, blue-throated, ruby-throated, magnificent, and Lucifer seek out these flowers.
Along with its plant and animal life, the park is also rich in cultural history. Archaeological records of humans in the area go back about 10,000 years, beginning with the prehistoric Paleo-Indians. Later on, the Chisos Indians lived here, as did the Comanche and Jumano people and other native groups. Spanish explorers began to arrive in the area in the 1500s. They were searching for gold and fertile land. They described this land as despoblado, or uninhabited. Much of what is now Big Bend National Park was Mexican territory until 1848. Mexican settlers farmed and raised animals here. In the early 1900s, many Anglo-Americans began settling in the area.
President Franklin D. Roosevelt established the park on June 12, 1944. It covers more than 320,000 hectares. For several years before the park was created, hundreds of men worked to build roads and trails to prepare the area for visitors. They built the 11-kilometer road that leads to the Chisos Mountains Basin. A basin is a large area of the Earth's surface that is lower than the area surrounding it. Today, the basin is a popular place within the park. Visitors can stay in the Chisos Mountain Lodge there or at campgrounds. One of the most popular hiking trails is the Lost Mine Trail. The trail goes up sharply through forests of pine, juniper, and oak trees. The 8-kilometer-long hike passes by lookout points for viewing the park's Juniper Canyon.
More than 300,000 people visit Big Bend each year. Most come between November and April, when the weather is cooler. A favorite way to explore the park is by boat on the Rio Grande. Many tour operators organize rafting trips. Rafting trips take you through many kilometers of beautiful deep canyons. They may last half a day or several days. On longer trips, travelers sleep next to the river in tents. Another way to enjoy the Rio Grande is in its many hot springs. These are places where hot water flows up from underground. The water temperature is over 40 degrees Celsius. The river's hot springs are said to have healing properties. They hold mineral salts from the earth. Big Bend National Park has offered beauty, excitement, and recreational challenge to visitors for more than 80 years. It is a true treasure of Texas and the larger United States. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.
The Furnished Room. Restless, always moving, forever passing, like time itself, are most of the people who live in these old red houses. This is on New York's West Side. The people are homeless, yet they have 100 homes. They go from furnished room to furnished room. They are transients, transients forever. Transients in living place, transients in heart and mind. They sing the song, Home Sweet Home, but they sing it without feeling what it means. They can carry everything they own in one small box. They know nothing of gardens. To them, flowers and leaves are something to put on a woman's hat. The houses of this part of the city have had 1,000 people living in them. Therefore, each house should have 1,000 stories to tell. Perhaps most of these stories would not be interesting. But it would be strange if you did not feel, in some of these houses, that you were among people you could not see, The spirits of some who had lived and suffered there must surely remain, though their bodies had gone. One evening a young man appeared, going from one to another of these big old houses, ringing the doorbell. At the 12th house, he put down the bag he carried. He cleaned the dust from his face. Then he touched the bell. It sounded far, far away, as if it were ringing deep underground. The woman who owned the house came to the door. The young man looked at her. He thought that she was like some fat, colorless, legless thing that had come up from a hole in the ground, hungrily hoping for something or someone to eat. He asked if there was a room that he could have for the night.
"Come in," said the woman.
Her voice was soft, but for some reason he did not like it.
"I have the back room on the third floor. Do you wish to look at it?"
The young man followed her up. There was little light in the halls. He could not see where that light was coming from. The covering on the floor was old and ragged. There were places in the walls made, perhaps, to hold flowering plants. If this were true, the plants had died long before this evening. The air was bad. No flowers could have lived in it for long.
"This is the room," said the lady in her soft, thick voice. "It's a nice room. Someone is usually living in it. I had some very nice people in it last summer. I had no trouble with them. They paid on time. The water is at the end of the hall. Sprouls and Mooney had the room for 3 months. You know them? Theater people. The gas is here. You see, there's plenty of space to hang your clothes. It's a room everyone likes. If you don't take it, someone else will take it soon." "Do you have many theater people living here?"
asked the young man.
"They come and they go. Many of my people work in the theater. Yes, sir. This is the part of the city where theater people live. They never stay long anyplace. They live in all the houses near here. They come and they go."
The young man paid for the room for a week. He was going to stay there, he said, and rest. He counted out the money. The room was all ready, she said. He would find everything that he needed. As she moved away, he asked his question. He had asked it already 1,000 times. It was always there, waiting to be asked again.
"A young girl, Eloise Vashner. Do you remember her? Has she ever been in this house? She would be singing in the theater, probably. A girl of mid-height, thin, with red-gold hair, and a small dark spot on her face near her left eye. No, I don't remember the name. Theater people change names as often as they change their rooms. They come and they go. No, I don't remember that one."
"No. Always no." He had asked his question for 5 months, and the answer was always no. Every day he questioned men who knew theater people. Had she gone to them to ask for work? Every evening he went to the theaters. He went to the good theaters and to bad ones. Some were so bad that he was afraid to find her there. Yet he went to them, hoping. He who had loved her best had tried to find her. She had suddenly gone from her home. He was sure that this great city, this island, held her. But everything in the city was moving, restless. What was on top today was lost at the bottom tomorrow. The furnished room received the young man with a certain warmth, or it seemed to receive him warmly. It seemed to promise that here he could rest. There was a bed, and there were 2 chairs with ragged covers. Between the 2 windows there was a looking-glass about 12 inches wide. There were pictures on the walls. The young man sat down in a chair while the room tried to tell him its history. The words it used were strange, not easy to understand. as if they were words of many distant foreign countries. There was a floor covering of many colors, like an island of flowers in the middle of the room. Dust lay all around it. There was a bright wallpaper on the wall. There was a fireplace. On the wall above it, some bright pieces of cloth were hanging. Perhaps they had been put there to add beauty to the room. This they did not do. And the pictures on the walls were pictures the young man had seen 100 times before in other furnished rooms. Here and there, around the room, were small objects forgotten by others who had used the room. There were pictures of theater people, something to hold flowers, but nothing valuable. One by one, the little signs grew clear. They showed the young man the others who had lived there before him. In front of the looking-glass, there was a thin spot on the floor covering. It told him that women had been in the room. Small finger marks on the wall told of children trying to feel their way to sun and air. A larger spot on the wall made him think of someone, in anger, throwing something there. Across the looking-glass, some person had written the name Marie. It seemed to him that those who had lived in the furnished room had been angry with it, and had done all they could to hurt it. Perhaps their anger had been caused by the room's brightness and its coldness, for there was no true warmth in the room. There were cuts and holes in the chairs and in the walls. The bed was half broken. The floor cried out as if in pain when it was walked on. People, for a time, had called this room home, and yet they had hurt it. This was a fact not easy to believe, but perhaps it was, strangely, a deep love of home that was the cause. The people who had lived in the room perhaps never knew what a real home was, but they knew that this room was not a home. Therefore their deep anger rose up and made them strike out. The young man in the chair allowed these thoughts to move one by one, softly through his mind. At the same time, sounds and smells from other furnished rooms came into his room. He heard someone laughing in a manner that was neither happy nor pleasant. From other rooms he heard a woman talking too loudly. He heard people playing games for money. And he heard a woman singing to a baby. And he heard someone weeping. Above him there was music. Doors opened and closed. The trains outside rushed noisily past. Some animal cried out in the night outside. And the young man felt the breath of the house. It had a smell that was more than bad. It seemed cold and sick and old and dying. Then, suddenly, as he rested there, the room was filled with the strong, sweet smell of a flower, small and white, named Mignonette. The smell came so surely and so strongly that it almost seemed like a living person entering the room. And the man cried out aloud, "What, dear?" as if he had been called. He jumped up and turned around. The rich smell was near and all around him. He opened his arms for it. For a moment, he did not know where he was or what he was doing. How could anyone be called by a smell? Surely it must have been a sound. But could a sound have touched him? "She has been in this room," he cried. And he began to seek some sign of her. He knew that if he found any small thing that had belonged to her, he would know that it was hers. If she had only touched it, he would know it. This smell of flowers that was all around him, she had loved it and she had made it her own. Where did it come from? The room had been carelessly cleaned. He found many small things that women had left. Something to hold their hair in place, something to wear in the hair to make it more beautiful, a piece of cloth that smelled of another flower, a book. Nothing that had been hers. and he began to walk around the room like a dog hunting a wild animal. He looked in corners. He got down on his hands and knees to look at the floor. He wanted something that he could see. He could not realize that she was there, beside, around, against, within, above him, near to him, calling him. Then once again he felt the call. Once again he answered loudly, "Yes, dear," and turned wild-eyed to look at nothing. For he could not yet see the form and color and love and reaching arms that were there in the smell of white flowers. Oh, God, where did the smell of flowers come from? Since when has a smell had a voice to call? So he wondered and went on seeking. He found many small things left by many who had used the room. But of her who may have been there, whose spirit seemed to be there, he found no sign. And then he thought of the owner. He ran from the room with its smell of flowers, going down and to a door where he could see a light. She came out. He tried to speak quietly.
"Will you tell me," he asked her, "who was in my room before I came here?" "Yes, sir, I can tell you again. It was Sprouse and Mooney, as I said. It was really Mr. and Mrs. Mooney, but she used her own name. You see, the people do that."
"Tell me about Mrs. Mooney. What did she look like?"
"Black-haired, short and fat. They left here a week ago."
"And before they were here?"
"There was a gentleman, not in the theater business. He didn't pay. Before him was Mrs. Crowder and her two children. They stayed 4 months. And before them was old Mr. Doyle. His sons paid for him. He had the room 6 months. That is a year, and further, I do not remember."
He thanked her and went slowly back to his room. The room was dead. The smell of flowers had made it alive, but the smell of flowers was gone. In its place was the smell of the house. His hope was gone. He sat looking at the yellow gaslight. Soon he walked to the bed and took the covers. He began to tear them into pieces. He pushed the pieces into every open space around the windows and door. No air now would be able to enter the room. When all was as he wished it, he put out the burning gaslight. Then, in the dark, he started the gas again, and he lay down thankfully on the bed. It was Mrs. McCool's night to go out and get them something cold to drink. So she went and came back, and sat with Mrs. Purdy in one of those rooms underground where the women who own these old houses meet and talk.
"I have a young man in my third floor back room this evening,"
said Mrs. Purdy, taking a drink.
"He went up to bed 2 hours ago."
"Is that true, Mrs. Purdy?" said Mrs. McCool. It was easy to see that she thought this was a fine and surprising thing. "You always find someone to take a room like that. I don't know how you do it. Did you tell him about it?"
"Rooms,"
said Mrs. Purdy in her soft, thick voice,
"are furnished to be used by those that need them. I did not tell him, Mrs. McCool."
"You're right, Mrs. Purdy. It's the money we get for the rooms that keep us alive. You have the real feeling for business. There are many people who wouldn't take a room like that if they knew. If you told them that someone had died in the bed, and died by their own hand, they wouldn't enter the room."
"As you say, we have our living to think of,"
said Mrs. Purdy.
"Yes, it is true. Only 1 week ago I helped you there in the third floor back room. She was a pretty little girl, and to kill herself with the gas. She had a sweet little face, Mrs. Purdy."
"She would have been called beautiful, as you say,"
said Mrs. Purdy,
"except for that dark spot she had growing by her left eye. Do fill up your glass again, Mrs. McCool."
From VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.
It's music time.